Hello and welcome to our digestion assessment module part one. It's an overview and symptom review and pulling it together so that you get a review of some basic digestion stuff, but also a review from the standpoint of what's really going on, what can go wrong, and then how does it present symptomatically? Because if we're trying to assess the digestive tract, it's more than just testing, it's more than just labs, it's more than just looking at stool. It's a matter of looking at how the person presents. Historically, what have been the symptoms? How are they presenting in terms of their function day to day? So we're gonna look at all of that and pull it together before we head in to some of the more fun stuff in the digestion testing pieces of it in later parts of this module. All of the information I'm sharing with you and when you share with your clients is considered education. I'm educating you about ways that you can test, not telling you that you should get people to do this instead of what their doctor said or anything like that. You can take this slide and use it, make changes to it, and use it for your own purposes if ever you're doing slide presentations. But make sure that people know that you're giving them education, except in cases where you are licensed to do diagnosis and give medical advice. So let's just give you a background of why we're going to look at analyzing the digestive system. And the reason is because the digestive imbalances don't just affect the digestive system. They affect all of your body. They can create nutritional imbalances and deficiencies because if you're not fully digesting, absorbing the foods, the nutrients in your foods, you're going to have nutrient imbalances, which can lead to all sorts of problems. Digestion problems lead to inflammation, lead to toxin absorption. And both of these, it's through a mechanism we'll go into more detail about and how to test for, is called leaky gut, intestinal permeability. Digestive problems influence your immune system because of leaky gut and because of the inflammation that poor food choices and inflammation in your gut can have on the whole system. You can have immune imbalances. You can have allergies. You can have autoimmune conditions. They can lead to hormone imbalances. They can lead to imbalances in insulin, in thyroid, in adrenal. Stress in your digestive tract. Say that your client has stress in their digestive tract from a bug, a bacteria, candida, something along those lines, or inflammation. That's going to stress the system, and that's going to stress your adrenals. And we talked about that on the adrenal module. And then neurotransmitters. This is huge. People who have digestive issues can have neurotransmitter problems, meaning depression, difficulty focusing, not able to be motivated. And sometimes these people do not even show up with problems in their digestive tract. Isn't that unusual, right? Well, we know better than that. We know better than that. But it's important that we address it. So when you have people that present to you that are having immune problems or hormone imbalances, neurotransmitter problems, and they don't necessarily have digestive problems, I want you to be able to rule out the digestive problems. When people present to you, they're not just going to have digestive problems. That's easy to know that there's something in the digestion, but it's when it's all over the place. Osteoporosis, there's all sorts of things that can be a result of poor digestion. And I want you to be really keen on how you're going to handle those things. So as a review, these are the parts of the digestive tract. Starts with the mouth, the pharynx, the esophagus, goes down to the stomach, and then the small intestine, and then the liver gives the gallbladder some bile, and the bile secretes it into the small intestine. The pancreas does the same, and then it goes into the large intestine and out the other end. Okay, this is all covered in detail in the digestive module. The focus that we're going to have today is on assessing the digestion, and we're going to assess the three main functions of digestion. We're going to look at, when you're looking at a person, you want to see where the breakdown is. Is the breakdown in the digestion of the food, where your body's breaking the food down into molecules your body can use? Are you having a problem, is the person you're working with having a problem with absorption, where the molecules are actually absorbed into the bloodstream and carried through the body? Or are they having problems with elimination, that wastes are not being eliminated? So we're going to be talking about how to evaluate all of these areas when somebody presents to you either with digestive complaints or with something that isn't a direct digestive complaint, but that you know can be related to the digestion. So let's take a look at some of the ways that we have of assessing the digestive tract. Well, we can look for gastrointestinal symptoms, diarrhea, bloating, gas, belching, things like that, pain. These are all symptoms that are in the gut itself. And we have surveys that we can use, and you can be asking questions. And you can decide, as you do more and more with people, if you want to have questionnaires to make it shorter, or you want to ask them questions to really be able to dig deep. We're going to look at transit time. How long does it take to go from mouth to anus? It's a really critical thing. If you are talking to somebody and they're talking about, they could even be having a bowel movement every day, but have a transit time that's 48 hours. They may be pooping out the stuff that they ate 2 days ago. It's important for you to know this to be able to assess the function of the digestive tract. There's physical signs of nutrient deficiencies due to malabsorption. So they may have brittle nails, dry hair, hair that's falling out, dry skin. They may have bloated belly. There's a lot of physical signs, and you can either do a physical exam on them if that's within your scope of practice, or you can ask them to check these things. And I've given you in module 2 lots of good resources for you to be able to do that. You'd be looking for inflammation and allergic reactions. And we're going to go through, how do you assess inflammation? How do you assess allergic reactions? We're going to look at those tests. And you'll be asking them questions, of course, about that, but then you're probably going to want to dig further. And then you're going to be looking for symptoms outside the digestive tract, looking at their skin, their gums, their nails, their lips, their tongue, their joints, their bones. These are all really, really important. And finally, lab testing. So you see, people think about these assessing is all about lab testing. And there's so much that we can do before lab testing. I love lab testing, don't get me wrong. I love being able to see inside the body. But do I do it on everybody? No. I know a lot of practitioners do, but I really believe if you build up your skills in the interview process, the collecting the data process, the exam findings, and really pull it together, you're not going to have to do lab testing all the time. It's going to be really clear the more experience you get when the lab testing is needed and when it's not, and when you can, I don't want to say guess, but it's like an educated guess about what's going on. Or you could assume, like, I really think this person has a gut bug and she's never done anything to deal with that gut bug. Why don't we put her on some things to heal her leaky gut and that are anti-infective kinds of herbs and nutrients and get her on a clean diet and see. And then if that doesn't fix the problems, then you can go and do the lab testing. Sometimes people come in and right off the bat, you know they need some testing. Maybe it's because they've been to 4 other practitioners in the last 2 years. You know what I mean? And I'm sure you've all seen those or heard about people like that. Maybe they're your friends, maybe they're your patients. But those folks have been to a lot and they've done it all. And maybe they're on a great diet and they've been taking all kinds of stuff. Well, you want to find out what's in there. What's really going on in there so that you can make sure. Lab testing is wonderful, and I love lab testing, and I love doing it, but it's not necessarily the first line. I want you to hone in on your other skills. So again, this is what your digestive tract looks like. We start with the mind. We go to the mouth. We go to the esophagus, the stomach, the small intestine. The liver and the gallbladder secrete things into the small intestine, as does the pancreas, and finally the large intestine. And each of these areas, we're going to focus mainly on stomach on down. Each of these areas can have problems, and there's ways to assess them. So let's start with the stomach, and let's start with what can go wrong. I'm assuming you all have a pretty good grasp of what the stomach does. And if you don't, then after this, I recommend you don't go to Google and just find out more or pull out an anatomy and physiology book to refresh you on the stomach and the functions. I'll be refreshing you as we go along, but I don't want to teach you the anatomy and physiology. What I want to teach you is refresh you and review the main points and then talk about what can go wrong. So in the stomach produces hydrochloric acid to help you digest proteins and kill off microbes that come in with the food and help you with absorbing your minerals. Really important stuff. And some of the problems that you can have are related to the stomach acid. You can have achlorhydria, which means no hydrochloric acid, none. There's gone. You can have hypochlorhydria, which means low stomach acid. They can have too much stomach acid, hyperchlorhydria. That's what people think most of the problems related to burning in the stomach are. And quite frankly, most of them are related to low stomach acid. And we'll look at that in a little bit. But too much stomach acid can certainly contribute to ulcers and gastritis. But you know what? Too little stomach acid can contribute to ulcers and gastritis as well, because H. pylori is an infection that you get, and H. pylori thrives in an alkaline stomach environment. Isn't that interesting? So if you're not producing enough stomach acid, you have more of a tendency towards H. pylori. And when you have H. pylori, we'll go into a little bit more about it. It produces ulcers in your stomach. Isn't that interesting? It bores holes in. You can also have acid in the wrong place, right? Your stomach has this beautiful, thick, cushiony mucus lining to protect it from acid because it's supposed to produce acid. But the esophagus doesn't. The esophagus is the tube coming down and leading into the stomach. And it's just handling food. It's only supposed to be handling the food that you're putting in. And you know if that food is capable of passing the mouth test and going down your throat without burning, it should be able to go down your esophagus without burning. So what happens is the acid from the stomach leaks its way up into the esophagus and causes some erosion and inflammation and ulceration in the esophagus. So that's acid in the wrong place. And that's when people feel really uncomfortable, especially when they lay down, especially after they've had a large meal, because the sphincter between the esophagus and the stomach, the sphincter is not keeping the acid and the food content in the stomach. It's slipping back up. And that can happen for a number of reasons. And we're going to show you, I'll share with you, because these are questions you want to be asking to see if somebody has a predisposition to that. And then bad is stomach cancer. All of these are bad. They're not very comfortable, but you know, worse is stomach cancer. And enzyme insufficiency, it means that it's the pepsin enzyme that your stomach produces to help you break down your proteins. So the stomach gets you started on protein digestion, and you can have low pepsin, especially when you have low stomach acid. The enzyme insufficiency can also come from that pepsin is got to be activated into pepsinogen, which is the active form that can actually act on the protein. And without the hydrochloric acid, you don't make enough. You can't do that conversion. So when you're assessing someone and their stomach function, their digestive function, you're going to be asking a lot of questions or having them fill out a form. So I'm going to share with you the questions that you can ask for low stomach acid and excess stomach acid and how you could differentiate that when you have somebody sitting before you. These questions are taken from the questionnaires that I shared with you in Module 1, the Ninja Assessment, Ninja History Taking Skills. So low stomach acid and excess stomach acid. So on the low stomach acid side, it's general that they will have excessive belching or aching 1 to 4 hours after eating and gas almost immediately following a meal. It's because the stomach just can't work on that load that's in there. It causes offensive breath, because without being able to digest those proteins and without being able to really break down the foods that are coming into the stomach, you get putrefaction, you get fermentation, and that can cause bad breath. People with low stomach acid oftentimes have constipation. They have difficulty with having regular bowel movements. Maybe their bowel movements are too hard. They have a sense of fullness either during or after the meal because they're not digesting, right? The food is just sitting like a lump. That's what it feels like. And that's really what's happening. It's just not being broken down. So that sense of fullness happens almost immediately. People with low stomach acid tend to have difficulty digesting fruits and vegetables because the hydrochloric acid helps to break down the cellulose in those fruits and vegetables, mainly vegetables. You know, fruits are not as big a deal unless they're something with a really hard outer skin. But the vegetables have that big, thick cellulose wall that needs to be broken down. So if you have somebody that's saying to you, wow, I know I should be eating a lot of salad, but whenever I get eat a salad or raw vegetables, I tend to get really bloated and gassy. It could be because they have low stomach acid. And also they'll see undigested food in their stools. They will actually see particles of food, and they could actually recognize it when it comes out. Generally, you shouldn't be recognizing your food when it comes out the other end. So if your person tells you, yeah, I see, you know, things in the toilet that I don't look like they've been broken down at all, that's a sign of low stomach acid. So excess stomach acid, they will get stomach pain, burning, or aching 1 to 4 hours after the meal. But the burning is the key. The burning is more pronounced usually, but not necessarily. People can get burning even when they have low stomach acid. But the really harsh burning is oftentimes associated with excess stomach acid. The stomach is producing too much. And by the way, excess stomach acid is not common. As we age, we produce less and less. So if you have somebody who's in their 20s or teens complaining of burning pain, then I would pursue seriously that it could be excess stomach acid, especially if they're under a lot of stress. Like maybe they're a teenager and they're in school and they're really stressed and they're getting ready to take SATs and worried about going into college and they're complaining about that. That could be excess stomach acid. With excess stomach acid, this is a really key differentiator. They feel hungry an hour or two after eating. With low stomach acid, oftentimes they have that fullness right after eating. With the excess stomach acid, they're just burning it up so fast that it leaves the stomach really quickly. With excess stomach acid, they'll generally get heartburn when laying down or bending forward, and that's where reflux happens. Now, reflux doesn't have to happen when there's excess stomach acid. It can happen when there's low stomach acid as well, because any amount of acid going into the esophagus is not good. So when they lie down, that tends to push against the esophageal sphincter, and when they bend forward, the same thing. People with excess stomach acid will get relief from antacids, food, milk, and carbonated beverages temporarily. That people with low stomach acid, they won't get relief by eating more food. They won't get relief by eating more food. With excess stomach acid, the problems will often subside with rest and relaxation. That's not often the case with low stomach acid. Again, these two can be very close. There's just a few differentiators. And sometimes you can't tell the difference just by symptoms. Sometimes you need to do some testing to find out. But these people with excess stomach acid will end up with heartburn due to spicy foods, chocolate, citrus, peppers, alcohol, and caffeine. The ones with low stomach acid may get it from, like I said, vegetables. They may be fine with spicy foods because they don't have a problem with their mucus lining or their excess stomach acid, but they have a problem with being able to break down the cellulose, and that irritates. So that's a differentiator as well. We always want to do what we call differential assessment. It's like, what are the possible issues that can be underlying these particular symptoms? And how do we rule one in or one out so that we can hone in and narrow down to make an assessment? So let's take a look at some of the lab and exam assessments that you can do when you're trying to evaluate the stomach. On the physical exam side here, I have a couple of signs that are actually taken from kinesiological studies. And there's found that at the end of the sternum, towards the left rib cage, there's a tender spot, 1 inch below the end of the sternum and towards the left side. Tender spot. Also, sometimes there's a tender spot between the sixth and seventh and seventh and eighth ribs on the left. Those are neuro-lymphatic points in applied kinesiology, and they correspond to particular meridians in the acupuncture system. Signs of low protein. This is critical, like you know how to look for poor quality hair, nails, and skin. So some of the tests you can do. The HCL challenge test, and we're going to go through in detail what that is. I have a slide on that. The Heidelberg test. The Heidelberg test is not something that's done by very many people. It's not done that often. It's a very expensive test, but it's very informative. And basically what's involved with that test is somebody would take a little, it basically looks like a vitamin, but inside there's a little sensor, a little computer chip, and it goes through and the capsule breaks down and that will sit in the stomach and it measures the pH of the stomach. And then it makes its way through. You have to fish it out on the other end, so it'll come out in your stool on the other end. There are some MDs and some big clinics that have these machines, and they can be very informative. So I just wanted you to know, you're probably not going to use one of those, but I wanted you to know about it in case anybody ever comes in and says, yeah, and I had that Heidelberg test and my pH was whatever, that you know what they're talking about without having to go look it up in a book. And then low zinc on a zinc assay test. Zinc is super, super important for your digestion. It's super important to help you make hydrochloric acid and to activate the enzymes. And when you're low in zinc on a zinc assay test, that's a sign that your digestion is going to be compromised. And a zinc assay test is a liquid zinc. Several of the supplement companies make it. And you basically take a spoonful of that and you swish it in your mouth. And you wait to see if you get a taste. If after 30 seconds you don't get any taste at all, it means that you're very depleted in zinc. If the taste comes on in different regards in between, say it comes on in 10 seconds, you are depleted of zinc, but not as much as if it took 30. If it tastes awful right away, like really strong, then you probably have plenty of zinc. So this is a really easy test to get people to do. It's like a $15 bottle of zinc, and they can test themselves at home. The H. pylori test is you could do it as blood or stool, and that's we're gonna look at that in more detail. Some of the other things that you'll find on the blood are low ferritin, which comes from low iron, which comes from poor iron absorption, which comes from low stomach acid. Protein and globulin can be either elevated or depleted. And globulin is a type of protein, like immunoglobulin. It's one that makes immunoglobulins. If you're not digesting your protein well, if you're not absorbing it well, say you have low stomach acid or low protease enzyme, low pepsin in the stomach, then your protein might be low. If your protein's low, your globulin might also be low. But if you've got a massive immune problem going on in your gut, your globulin can be high. So it's important to kind of look at those. If they're in either direction off, it could be a sign of malabsorption. It could be a sign of a problem in the gut. When your BUN, blood urea nitrogen, is usually low, but it can also be high as a result of the stress on the system. But and I'll tell you why in a second, but when your BUN is low, it means you're either not getting enough protein or you're not absorbing enough protein, which could be a problem in the stomach, right? We just talked about that. The BUN is high, it oftentimes is related to kidney function, that your kidneys are not able to get rid of the urea and the nitrogen effectively and efficiently, and so it builds up. But it could also mean that you're not getting in enough protein and you're breaking down your muscle tissue to turn into protein and amino acids so for you to use. And so if it's high, it could go either way, so you'd have to be looking at your labs and to see if there are other signs of kidney problems or other signs of digestive problems. And we went over that a lot in module 3. And then phosphorus could be low. Again, it's a mineral, and you know, minerals tend to be low when your stomach's out of whack. So let's talk about HCL challenge. The HCL challenge, it's a home test. So it's something that your client or patient can do at home very inexpensively. They just need to invest in a small bottle of HCL, 500 to 650 milligram capsules of HCL with 150 milligrams of pepsin. You don't want them to get tablets, and you don't ever want them to open up the capsules. It'll burn their mouth and their esophagus. It's really important. Tablets might break down as they're going down. I highly recommend you just stick with hydrochloric acid capsules to do this test. And then you're going to have them take a little bit, one HCL, after a few bites of food. You don't want them to take it on an empty stomach or after the meal is over. Why? Because there's not the food in there for it to act upon, and it's going to burn. One thing I did find, I had somebody who was extremely sensitive, and what she did was she got some extra capsules, and she opened up her HCL capsule, and she poured half of it into another one and only took a half as she was testing, because she knew she's very sensitive. And that can be done too. You can have people do that. So no, if you have somebody who's like super sensitive and you have to go really slow with giving them any changes at all, then you may want to do that, either cut it in fourth or third or half. So if they eat the meal with the one HCL and they don't have any discomfort, like a burning or a warm sensation in their meal, we're going to just keep adding to it. So the next time they eat a meal that's similar. So here's the thing. When you're having them test this, tell them to test it on their biggest meal of the day to start. You can always go back and figure out what they need for the other meals, but only take it and test it on the biggest meal, so that there's some food in their stomach, there's some protein in their stomach, and there's less likelihood of them having the burning sensation. But they will get a warm sensation when they've reached their threshold or just exceeded it. So if they experience pain, hopefully not burning or a warm sensation, then they can counteract that right away with a teaspoon of slippery elm and 8 ounces of warm water, or a quarter cup of aloe vera juice, or a quarter teaspoon baking soda in water. So that's what I would have them do. So make sure that they know. I have this handout that I give people. It's very detailed. And then the next meal, if they experience pain, burning, or a warm sensation, on the next meal, they go back to the dose that caused no pain. And if they didn't, then they could add one more. But really only use this with people who don't already have gastritis or an ulcer. If they're complaining of burning, you're going to have to first do a whole protocol. And in fact, I'd recommend you do a protocol to repair before you do this. Get them on some slippery elm and marshmallow or DGL or some of those demulcent kinds of herbs that will help to coat and soothe the stomach before you start to try to get their HCL up to speed, because otherwise it could backfire. And then you lose trust when you get people into a series of pain. And don't ever let them go above 4 unless you really know what you're doing and have done this before. So I'm going to give you the causes of abnormal stomach secretions, not enough or too much acid or pepsin, because these are questions you want to be asking people. You want to see if they have a predisposition to this. You want to see if their lifestyle is predisposing them. So if they consume gastric irritants like alcohol, coffee, or cigarettes, and caffeine in the form of black tea, which also has a lot of tannins, can also do the same thing as coffee. Green tea, green coffee don't tend to do the same thing. It's the black that's full of caffeine. If they have allergens in food, so if they're telling you things that make it seem like they're having an allergic reaction, they're reacting poorly to their food, it could be it could be a cause. It could be an inflammatory stimulator of poor stomach secretions. Definitely going to ask them about their drug history. So if they're on any kind of drugs for stomach acid, proton pump inhibitors, that can be causing it. And basically any kind of drugs like ibuprofen and all the NSAIDs can cause problems with stomach irritation and abnormal stomach secretions under or over. When they chronically overeat, that will disrupt the secretion of hydrochloric acid and pepsin in the stomach and create a problem. Nasty bugs, you know, they've got H. pylori, or if they've got some sort of a candida infection or some sort of bacterial overgrowth, which we'll talk about soon, that can create a problem and interfere with the stomach's ability to produce properly. We've already mentioned H. pylori, and H. pylori is a huge problem in health. It causes the stomach to produce less acid, and that aggravates the lining. And when you don't have enough stomach acid, it relaxes that lower esophageal sphincter, and it causes it to open, and that can cause reflux. People who are under chronic unremitting stress, or chronic stress of any kind, where their sympathetic nervous system is dominant, and what that means is that they're running on high levels of cortisol, and cortisol shuts down digestion. It decreases the ability of your stomach to produce secretions. It also affects your liver. Thyroid and adrenal problems. So if your thyroid is underactive, it's going to be the metabolic rate of every tissue in your body is going to be underactive, and you may not be making enough stomach acid. And same thing with adrenal problems. If your adrenals are stuck on overdrive or they're weak, and that can cause a problem. Autoimmune diseases. And we're going to find out that you can make autoantibodies to just about anything. And you can make autoantibodies to the parietal cells in your stomach, which produce the acid and pepsin. You can also make antibodies to intrinsic factor, which is something that your body produces in the stomach, and it will interfere with your B12 absorption. Deficiencies of certain key nutrients, especially zinc, vitamin B1, and folate, are particularly important for creating and keeping that nice mucous membrane and producing stomach acid. And it will interfere if you don't have that, enough of those. When you eat a devitalized diet, when if you have somebody that's coming in and they're eating Cheetos and McDonald's hamburgers, and they don't have greens and bitter foods in there, that's going to affect the stomach secretions. Bitter foods stimulate your stomach to produce stomach acid. So it's really a nice idea. You can get people to juice a little bit of vegetable before a meal, green, or they can just chew on a piece of dandelion or arugula that's really bitter and just chew it to a pulp and keep it in the mouth longer than you normally would. That can help them to stimulate their stomach acid. And finally, there are genetic issues. There tend to be certain populations that have more difficulties with acid production. And some of these are listed here, the natives of the Pima Indians, Hispanic, Northern Eastern European descendants. So if you've got somebody who's Hispanic or from, one of the native tribes or Pima Indians, or they're from Eastern Europe, you want to be making sure you're being careful about asking them questions about their digestion and their stomach. So let's talk about H. pylori. Many of you probably have already heard about H. pylori. It's gotten a lot of popular press recently. And when I say recently, I mean over the last several years. It's a bacteria, and it has the ability to bore itself into the stomach lining, like to drill holes. You see these little antenna that it's wearing? Those antenna can bore themselves into the stomach lining, and it can take residence there. It is said now that H. pylori is the cause of most ulcers. I kind of don't buy into that, in that when you say that that's the causative factor, I don't think that's entirely true. I think that there's a susceptibility to the H. pylori, and a lot of that has to do with lifestyle factors and medications and all the things we talked about earlier that are predisposing you to having problems here. But H. pylori is just, it's like it goes into the fertile soil and it bores its way in. If you have a really healthy, intact digestion to begin with, an immune system to begin with, it wouldn't be taken over. So there's something to be said about, yes, it is a causative factor, but is it the true underlying causative factor? So what are some of the symptoms of H. pylori? Well, typically, the most predominant symptom is gnawing or burning. in the abdominal area, so gnawing or burning abdominal pain. And it's usually just below the ribs, and it's worse on an empty stomach. And it feels like you have an ulcer. You may not have an ulcer, you may just have H. pylori. You may not have an ulcer or H. pylori, you may have gastritis, just a breakdown of the mucous membrane lining the stomach, or you may have excess stomach. So this is a symptom that would be common to several different things. But you're pulling it all together, you're playing detective, right? H. pylori can sometimes cause loss of appetite. Some people say, well, I would like to have some H. pylori because I'd like my appetite to go away. But that's not the way you want to lose weight. It can lead to bloating or burping. It can also lead to nausea or vomiting. It can lead to black, tarry stools, autoimmune diseases, and cardiovascular, skin, liver, and biliary symptoms. So it can have effects all over the body. And like leaky gut and like some of the other of the symptoms that we're going to be talking about in the digestive tract, it sometimes has what they call the extra gastrointestinal manifestations first. It may show signs outside of the gut before it shows signs in the gut. There's a hidden H. pylori infection. So let's talk about how to test for this bugger and find out if it's really there. Well, there's a number of tests, and they're not all 100% accurate. They can miss some of the H. pylori. I studied with the Dr. Amy Yasko, who works a lot with autistic kids, and she sees a lot of H. pylori. But you know, a lot of times it's hidden, and there's things that you look for on the stool test to tell you that maybe there's a hidden H. pylori. And because there's other bugs in there, you don't see the H. pylori. Yeah, so there's ways to bring it out, and there's ways to test for it that are more accurate than others. So you can do some stool testing, which means you just basically, in the lab, we'll talk more about this as we go on, you poop into a little container, and then they have your patient stir it up and put it in the little vial that they send you and send it off. So Metametrics Clinical Lab has this as part, the H. pylori testing as part of a test it calls GI effects. And by the way, I've given you a nice, easy, handy dandy. At the end of this, I have links to all of these labs, plus and then some. So Genova Diagnostics, which has recently merged with Metametrics, although they still have two websites, so it'll be interesting to see how that goes. They have it as part of their CDSA, which is Comprehensive Digestive Stool Analysis, and they also have a CDSA level 2, or you can order it as a standalone test or an add-on to one of the tests that don't include it. BioHealth. BioHealth has it as an optional part of their GI panel, or you could do it standalone if you're just going back to retest it. One of the things that I've found is for microbes, for H. pylori in particular, I find BioHealth to be the most sensitive. I've had people who I suspected had H. pylori. We did the GI effects. It said they were fine. It could have been that it was several months later and we'd done some things to help get the H. pylori out of hiding. But when we did the BioHealth, it showed up. So anyway, then we were able to treat it and she got tremendous results from that. And then Doctor's Data is a lab that does stool testing. These are the four top labs in the U.S. that do stool testing, and you can add it to their stool chemistries profile or standalone. We're going to be going through a little bit more detail about what's in all of these tests, and you're going to have to decide where you want to order tests from. And some of these you can order, like Metametrics and Genova, and Doctor's Data too, three out of four, you can actually order on direct labs. And the BioHealth will only sell through a practitioner, and you actually have to have a license. So they're a little picky. The blood antibody test for H. pylori is the least accurate of the testing. The jury's out as to what's the most accurate. Because you can also do this thing called the urea breath test. And basically, you have this bag, and you have a little tube that you put in your mouth and closes off the air from the outside. You blow into the bag, and then there's a little syringe that you stick into part of the end of it, and it sucks out the air that you breathed out, and then it's tested. Breath tests are getting more and more common. You can do a urea breath test. And the urea breath test is sensitive for H. pylori because it's one of the byproducts that H. pylori secretes. So that's a good test. And we'll talk later as we go into further down in the gut, there's another kind of breath test that you can do. And the good thing about the breath test is it's non-invasive and they can do it at home. Now, stomach biopsy, I don't know about you, but I don't like that idea. Now, that's a very invasive test, but of course it is a way to test to see if somebody has H. pylori. It's not commonly used at all. We talked a little bit earlier about gastroesophageal reflux, GERD. It's also called heartburn. And we talked about that as having the symptoms of having burning going up your esophagus, especially when you're sleeping at night. So what I wanted to do was give you a list of symptoms that you can be asking for and looking for when you're evaluating somebody's digestive tract. If they tell you like, oh, I eat, and then the food, it just feels like it's trapped behind the breastbone, that can be a sign of GERD. They have burning pain in the chest that's worse with bending, lying down, and at night. Talked about that already. If they tell you they get nauseous after eating, that could be a sign of GERD. It could be a sign that that sphincter is not holding the stomach contents down and they're feeling like they need to regurgitate it. And sometimes they do. When they have difficulty swallowing, it's often because their GERD has been going on for a while and they've got some lesions, some irritation, maybe some ulcerations even, in their throat, and it's hard to swallow. Hiccups tends to be a common complaint with people with GERD, and maybe it's because they're sucking in too much air when they eat. Hoarseness or change in voice, I've seen this a lot, and also sore throat, really sore throat, and they don't understand why. They don't have a cold, they don't have post-nasal drip, and they just have this sore throat. Here's the thing, if it's caused by GERD, oftentimes if you have them suck on a DGL lozenge, that's deglycerizinated licorice, that will help the sore throat. If the sore throat is from an infectious disease or strep, the DGL is not necessarily going to help, or it may not for very long. And then sometimes people cough or wheeze because of that feeling they have in their chest and their throat from the reflux, the food that's popping back up where it shouldn't be. It should be a one-way street. It shouldn't have backflow. You know, if you ever let somebody borrow your, if you ever let a kid borrow your water bottle and they suck on it and they have backflow. We don't want that here. So what are some of the possible causes of GERD? Well, overeating. If you eat more than your stomach can hold comfortably, some of it's going to push up against that esophageal sphincter and it's going to go uphill. It's just going to. If you exercise vigorously after eating, I think most of us know not to do that, but some people aren't aware of that. They're trying to fit exercise in and then they go for a run or a hike up a mountain right after they eat. That can trigger GERD. Alcohol definitely does. It relaxes that lower esophageal sphincter, as just caffeine. So in somebody who has GERD, you want to be careful about coffee and also chocolate and black tea. If somebody wears really tight clothes, it can push against that stomach, and the stomach, where's it going to go when it's being pushed in and it's full? Right back up. So tight garments are not a good idea. If the person says to you, God, I don't know what's wrong with me. I have to take off my bra and loosen my shirt, and my pants, I just feel all like big after I eat. I feel like I get regurgitation after I eat if I keep those tight garments on. Well, they may have some GERD going on. If somebody is eating while or right before reclining, you know, if you're sitting in that recliner chair about to watch something on TV and you're just reclining back and eating at the same time, probably not a great idea. If you've experienced any of this kind of these kind of symptoms, probably not a good idea to do on a regular basis, even if you haven't, because you can create it. And then smoking and stress, and we talked a little bit about how those fall in. So how are you going to use this information on this slide? Well, this is the stuff that you're going to be asking people. You're going to be asking them about their habits, And so if they have a bunch of these habits and they're having some of these symptoms, you're going to want to pursue it further and see if this is what's going on for them. So that's about it for the stomach. And I want to move down to the pancreas. And the pancreas sits on the left side of your body, and it's right underneath the ribcage, right behind the stomach. You could see it in the picture. And the pancreas has got a really important job. It squirts out the enzymes that they produce in there that help you to digest your food. So what can go wrong is a direct relationship to the function of the pancreas. Well, it's supposed to be putting out enzymes. And if it doesn't do its job, you can have enzyme insufficiency, which means you don't digest your food really well. Your food goes through you undigested. You can have pancreatitis. Now, pancreatitis is one of those things that's most common in alcoholics, but it can be caused by other things as well. And the pancreas gets inflamed. It's very painful. It's very common with people who are alcoholics or who drink to excess. And to excess is probably relative to who they are and what their life is like and their body is like. But I think drinking on a regular basis can contribute to pancreatitis, as well as liver and liver cirrhosis and brain dysfunction and all sorts of other things, candida. Pancreatic cancer oftentimes is a sequela, means it follows pancreatitis. So somebody who has pancreatic cancer, it's considered one of the hardest cancers to treat. I believe that that's what the Apple guy, Steve Jobs, died of, was pancreatic cancer. It can come from having just giving your pancreas too much work over time, right? And not nourishing it. Eating too many processed and cooked foods and not eating them quickly enough so the pancreas is working overtime, squirting out enzymes. It can come from irritation from having problems with insulin, keeping your insulin levels at bay. So there's a lot of reasons that you can end up with these problems. So let's talk about some of the symptoms that you may see, and you may be asking people about pancreatic insufficiency. Well, gas and bloating, half an hour to several hours after eating. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? That's similar to low stomach acid. Again, you have to be a detective to figure out what's what. Chronic bloat and gas 1 to 2 hours after eating. Chronic constipation, diarrhea, or alternating. A lot of undigested food in the stool. Again, these are very similar to the low stomach acid, so I'm just going through them quickly. Frequent bubbles or grease in the toilet bowl. This is different from low stomach acid. This is because you're not getting enough lipase, the fat digesting enzyme. But the bubbles or grease in the toilet bowl can also be related to your liver or gallbladder. If you have stools that are chronically very light in color, it's actually more related to bile. It's more related to the gallbladder and liver, but it can be related to the pancreas. And then undigested food and foul-smelling stool and mucus-like, greasy, or poorly formed. You also can end up with fat-soluble vitamin deficiencies because you're not getting enough lipase to break it down. It can also come with gallbladder and liver stuff. And you have somebody who's taking steps to improve themselves, but not getting the appropriate response. So they start to eat more greens, and they start to eat more fruit, and they start to go get off of some of the foods that are not as good for them. But they're not getting the right response. They may not be making enough pancreatic enzymes. And it's not hard to fix, right? We can supplement with enzymes. Indigestion and fullness, that lasts 2 to 4 hours. People who have difficulty losing weight, pain and tenderness under the left ribcage where it exists. They pass a lot of gas because there's a lot of undigested food going through the system and it's subject to breaking down and rotting. They may get nausea or vomiting. Frequent urination, decreased thirst and appetite has to do with the pancreas being deficient in producing insulin. And those are signs of diabetes. So again, I'm going to just run through them quickly because I want to get on to the lab testing. But the causes of low pancreatic enzymes are things that you're going to be looking for in their history. Do they have a history of autoimmune disease? Do they have cystic fibrosis? Do they drink a lot of alcohol or regularly drink it? Do they have a lot of stress in their lives? Are they eating a lot of processed food, which makes the pancreas have to produce more enzymes? Are they overeating a lot? Are they overeating cooked food? This concludes the assessment of the upper part of the GI system. There's no real lab tests other than testing for H. pylori that you do for the upper GI. You can certainly test amylase and lipase for pancreatic dysfunction, and that's often done. There's imaging studies that are done to see if there's any problems with the pancreas. But now we're going to move into, on the next videos, we're going to move into the assessment of the intestines, and that's where the juice comes in. That's where there's a lot more testing that you can do. There's stool testing and breath testing and a whole bunch more. So this concludes, and we'll see you on the next video.